y'all. Thanks for listening to Killer Queens.
Or KQ if you're nasty.
Welcome to the show where two 90s loving country chicks gab about true crime and tell each other to talk to the hand because the face ain't listening. I'm Torella.
And I'm Tori.
And we're sisters who have always loved true crime and decided to turn that obsession into a show with a light take on the topic.
Kind of like diet true crime, it's all the flavor and fewer calories.
Now with our show, you'll get true crime, 90s nostalgia, and a few four-letter words sprinkled in.
Because I always say that Polly Pockets and true crime go together like peas and carrots.
Be sure to check out our case submission form on our website at killerqueenspodcast.com and follow us on social media and YouTube.
Now grab your Surge, your 3D Cool Ranch Doritos, and your kitten surprise, and let's get into the episode.
This episode contains discussion of murder and mentions of suicide. It also involves children. Listener discretion is advised.
On Monday, November 13th, 1961, a crewman aboard an oil tanker spotted something in the water. It was a man in a dinghy waving frantically to get their attention. They rescued the man, and he told a harrowing story of how he found himself in the small vessel adrift at sea. While some believed him, others had serious doubts about his story, and another rescue days later cast further doubts on his tale. The second rescue was of 11-year-old Terry Jo Duperrault, and she told a much different version of the events that left her adrift at sea.
Hey, you guys, welcome to Killer Queens. If you've never been here before, we want to give you just a little information about how the show is set up and what it's meant to accomplish. If you have been here before, welcome back. You can just use that handy skip ahead feature here if you want to.
We want to give a message to friends and family of the victims. We know that there may be someone involved in the case who might listen one day, and we want you to know that our intention is to only bring awareness to this case. And while we do use personal stories in some instances and our own humor in order to tell the story in a way that listeners can relate, we have the utmost respect for victims and their families.
We created Killer Queens to be a place where we can have open discussions about cases just like you would with friends. We are not investigators. We use information that is available to the public, such as documentaries, case files, and media coverage. Using this information, we intend to tell the story of what happened in each case that we cover. Now, will you agree with our interpretations or conclusions of each case? Well, heck no.
Mm-mm. We each approach cases from different perspectives, life experiences, and beliefs that we already have in place. And sometimes these differences are slight, yet they can be wide enough to cause divide and upset some of those listening. We do our best to present the facts as we find them in our research, but we do bring our own perspectives to the case. We understand that you will too. We want you to know that this is a safe space to discuss differences and opinions in a civilized manner. Our style may not be your personal preference, and if that's the case, we know you'll be able to find one of the many other shows out there to tell the story the way you want to hear it. We can be grown-ups about it if you can.
Now, if we are your cup of tea and you want even more KQ, you can join our Patreon and get access to our entire catalog of episodes ad-free and access to bonus episodes too. And I'll give you just a little hint if you're an ad skipper, but you still want the deals that we have from our sponsors each week, you can scroll down to the show notes and see what coupons we have available for you right down there.
But you didn't hear from us.
That's a pro tip, but I'll deny ever sharing it.
Right. So all that being said, let's get into the story.
All right. I don't think we've ever had a sea rescue before.
I don't believe we have.
So this one's a wild ride.
Yeah. Strap in, babies.
Yeah. The amount of audacity, I think.
Yeah.
Heavy doses of audacity. So get ready for that.
Yeah, definitely.
Ugh. All right. And we want to give a hey girl thanks to Kelsey Gardner for requesting this case.
Yes. Thank you. And thank you to Mark for writing it up.
Thank you. All right, so let's get into it. Tori said Duperrault. I'm going to say Duperrault, and we're going to cover both pronunciations. So yes, that will minimize the amount of comments we get that say we didn't say it right. So hopefully only half.
It's been said both ways, so you could...
I've heard it both ways. The Duperrault family resided in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Arthur Duperrault was the husband of Jean, and they had three children. So Brian was 14 at the time, Terry Jo was 11 at the time, and Renee was 7. Arthur was a successful eye doctor, and during World War II, he'd been on boats that sailed in and around the Florida Keys and the Bahamas. And he really loved that experience, and it kind of stuck with him. And so over the years, he wanted to go back to the Florida Keys during the winter months in Green Bay. I can't imagine how disgusting it is there.
Understandably so. I mean, we're in winter times right now, and I'm freezing my baguettes off.
Oh my gosh.
And we're in the South.
Mm-hmm. And we're in the 40s for a high right now. Next week, not so much, but yeah, that's tough. Our writer Beth sent a picture the other day of what she is looking at, and she's in Wisconsin, and it looks like a freaking winter wonderland. And she said she shoveled snow for like 2 hours that day. I was like, yuck.
Beautiful photos.
Sure. Beautiful.
Don't want no part of it, though.
Not my journey. Not my journey. So Arthur was the same way. And he's like, let's get down there, you know, Beach Boys style.
I was going to say that. Aruba, Jamaica.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly like that. What he originally wanted to do was spend an entire year on a boat, and they'd just sail from place to place. You know, the family would just kind of explore, the kids would do, you know, their own thing, and they could snorkel and just, you know, like catch what they were going to eat and like all that kind of stuff. And that was his like ideal, like, this is where we want to get to. But they started saving money because obviously something like that is going to be pretty expensive. And at a certain point, they ended up kind of looking at it and saying, okay, well, we've got enough money where we could do like a mini version of that vacation. Like, let's test it out first, because we just don't know what it's going to be like with three kids, how they're going to do. And we don't want to be stuck there for a year and like everybody hate it and not have any fun. And yeah, not be enjoyable. So they ended up renting a ship for a week, and they were going to spend that week living aboard a chartered yacht in the warm weather, to, again, escape the brutal Green Bay winter for a short time. They had planned out different cities and ports to visit while out at sea, and they even had a plan in place to extend their trip if everyone was enjoying themselves. The cost to rent the yacht was around $500 at the time, plus the cost of paying a captain and making sure the boat was stocked with enough supplies. There's not really much available regarding the family's lives before their vacation. By all accounts, they were an average American family. They were probably a little more upper class than middle class. Arthur was said to have been liked by his patients. His children got along with friends at school. Really kind of, up until this point, uneventful, which I would argue is what you want your life to be in that regard. Like, you know, they're just living like a simple life. Got the kids, he's got his practice, he's got his wife, you know, they're fine. Like,
yeah, like no news has friends. Good news with that,
yeah,
kind of
well
stuff.
Liked,
yeah.
Like that kind of stuff. So they rented a ship named the Bluebell. It was a 60-foot twin-masted sailboat that was based out of Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And Arthur did have some experience sailing, but this was not within his wheelhouse. I mean, he's not prepared at this time to handle a ship this size in the open waters around the Caribbean. Hey y'all, we know that in February, the vibe is like all about showing love, care, and affection for other people. It's all about like love being in the air, right? But it can be easy to forget that your true soulmate is yourself. Don't forget to take care of you too. Sometimes I have a hard time remembering to be kind to myself. There are days where I feel like I'm not doing enough at home or work. I'm not staying hydrated enough. I didn't work out enough. I ate too much ice cream again. Like, the list goes on and on. And it's so easy to focus on the negative and neglect self-care. But we can't show up in the best way for others without caring for ourselves first. One of the best forms of self-love is taking care of your skin. And also, it feels great too. So you can feel good on the inside and out. And that's why we're super excited to partner with Apostrophe. Their whole goal is to help you feel confident in your own skin. Whatever it is that you're dealing with, breakouts, signs of aging, or acne scarring, Apostrophe will help you love the skin you're in. Apostrophe is an online platform that connects you with an expert dermatology team to get customized acne treatment for your unique skin. Through Apostrophe, you can get access to oral and topical medications that use clinically proven ingredients to help clear acne. Simply fill out an online consultation about your skin goals and medical history. Then snap a few selfies and a dermatology provider will create a customized treatment plan just for you. Apostrophe offers access to prescription treatments for all types of acne, from hormonal acne to facial acne and even back, chest, and butt acne. Treat breakouts from head to toe. You know what I love about aging? Hormonal acne and fine lines and wrinkles. They're like so cute. But a wise man named Borat once said, "Not," and that really resonated with me, you know? And I love that Apostrophe is helping me with both of those goals through their tailor-made plan for exactly what you're looking to work on. And if I can make my skin look and feel better without having to leave my house, that is a win-win for me. We have a special deal for our audience. Get your first visit for only $5 at apostrophe.com/queens when you use our code QUEENS. That's a savings of $15. This code is only available to our listeners. So to get started, just go to apostrophe.com/queens and click get started. Then use our code QUEENS at sign up and you'll get your first visit for only $5. Thank you, Apostrophe, for sponsoring this episode. So in Fort Lauderdale, Arthur hired 44-year-old Julian Harvey to captain the Bluebell for the family's vacation. Harvey was a well-known yachtsman to the locals. And in fact, he and Arthur actually already knew each other. So it wasn't, which is just like a fact that breaks your heart, because you have more trust in people that you already know or have been acquainted with, or that you have friends in common and like that kind of stuff. So it wasn't hard for him to make the decision to hire Arthur. I'm sorry, to hire Julian, Arthur to hire him. Julian was a veteran of the armed forces. He'd been a pilot in World War II and the Korean War. He flew 29 combat missions in World War II and over 100 during the Korean War, and was discharged in 1958 with the permanent rank of major. And Arthur agreed to pay Harvey $100 a day to be the captain, and then also to have Harvey's wife, Mary, come along and serve as a cook for the family. So that's kind of like, I mean, that's a win-win for the Harveys. Like,
yeah.
Hey, we get to go on a boat for a week. Like, yeah, sign me up.
Definitely. So the family boarded the Bluebell around midday on November 8th, 1961. Later that afternoon, they left port and set off on their vacation. And over the course of the next 4 days, they traveled to various locations throughout the Caribbean. They made stops in Bimini, the westernmost district of the Bahamas, and Sandy Point, which is in the northern Bahamas and about 190 or so miles from Miami. The family explored the islands they visited, and where they were available, they purchased souvenirs for themselves or friends and family back home. They spent their days on the beaches they came to, and the kids absolutely loved being in the water and tried to snorkel whenever they could. Now, I have never been snorkeling, but Torella has, and...
You've never been snorkeling?
Never have. Never have.
That's right. It's wonderful.
Well, Torella, let's hear a little bit about your experience snorkeling.
Well, I love it, but when we were in... This was for our honeymoon, and so I guess we were in St. Thomas, and then we took a ferry over to St. John, and like, if you can ever go to St. John and snorkel, like, please do it. It's phenomenal. But just like literally the first day that like we went snorkeling, and I think that was my first time snorkeling, like I put my face in the water, and like you see all the, because there's so many things to see there, you know, all kind of like bright, colorful fish and like all these kind of things. And like, I put my face in the water and I swear to you, it's like in a movie where like face is in the water under the sea and Little Mermaid starts playing. Take my face out, it stops. Put it back in under the sea. Like the whole time I'm snorkeling, and we snorkeled for days. Like that's like all we did. We would just go to different like parts of the beach. Like we'd drive to this bay and we'd drive to this bay and like whatever. And we would snorkel. And it was literally like, as soon as my face went in the water, it's like, it's so, I don't know. It's so funny.
That's awesome.
But it's also just like really fun.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it. Like, if I had to guess, I would say it probably sounds pretty fun.
Like, pretty fun. There were a couple times where we would get out a little bit further, and then I would see like a big fish with like sharp looking teeth, and I would hightail my ass back. Like, Andrew would be like, "I looked up and your ass was gone." Like,
so like, if I'm not we're getting talking eaten today, if we're talking Little Mermaid terms, I'm guessing you're flounder.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. There were a few times I did the equivalent of like a dead sprint in the water.
Like those like I lizards right that can walk there on water. Yeah.
Yeah. Like
or run
like,
on no water.
Like literally he'd like have his face down and he'd look up and be like, "Where'd she
where
go?
The hell'd she go?"
And I'm like, gone. Nope. You exactly can get eaten. That's not my journey.
But anyway, all that to say that they love to snorkel.
I don't blame them.
Really took a detour there. But so basically, all in all, those first 4 days that they were out at sea were pretty much uneventful. Just the family, along with the Harvey family, and you know, it's him and his wife. They're just exploring, they're enjoying one another's company, just living life on the boat.
Yeah. They seem to all get along pretty well too. Like, yeah, it seemed like everybody was. This is probably something they would have repeated. Arthur probably would have hired him to do their year thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Which makes it all the more confusing. Like, you just don't see what's coming, obviously.
Yeah.
But on November 12th, Arthur and Harvey had visited the office of a British official in the last port they visited. Their plans were to then start the journey back to Fort Lauderdale. And while there, Arthur told the commissioner they met with, Roderick Pinder, quote, "This has been a once-in-a-lifetime vacation. We'll be back before Christmas." And he was basically implying that they were all enjoying it so much that they would make another trip within the next few weeks. They set sail again, making their way back to Florida. And later that evening, Mary made chicken cacciatore and a salad that everybody enjoyed.
So around 12:30 p.m. on November 13th, the oil tanker Gulf Lion was trekking along through the water when a crewman spotted something. And as the tanker got closer, it became clearer and clearer until they realized what it was. It was a man waving frantically, desperately trying to get their attention. As they got closer, they could hear him yelling for help. And he said, he was yelling like, "Help, I have a dead baby on board." He kept saying that, but there was a dead girl on the dinghy with him. The crew jumped into action. They got him on board, and then they found the body of a young girl in a life jacket. The man said that his name was Julian Harvey. He told the crew that he had been hired to skipper the Bluebell for the Dupereau family, and the little girl was their youngest daughter, Renee. And I read that at first, or I heard. Sometimes I read, sometimes I hear. I don't know. But that he actually confused her with Terry. Like, he called her Terry at first. So there was a lot of confusion about who was who and like all that kind of stuff, which right. also like just goes to show you. Yeah. He's been on the boat with these people for 4 days, exclusively this family. There's only three children. Get it together, yeah, sir. Like, that just shows you how much he only pays attention to himself. I feel like.
Very true. Yeah.
And of course, you know, this crew is like, dude, like, what the hell happened, right? So he says that around 8:30 the previous night, the Bluebell ran into a sudden, extremely strong squall. And I appreciate Mark putting this in here because I don't know. I know what a squall line is because I am an emphatic weather watcher here. And so, like, I get more scared when I hear, like, Lisa or Nancy, depending on which news channel you're watching, say, "And here's the squall line," because it to me, my just context clues is like, you know, there's like little storms all over when they line up and it's that one big line, like that goes all the way, like cuts through the state, maybe multiple states. That's when they call it a squall line. And that feels scarier to me because I feel like it's like they're banding together and like strength in numbers or something. So that's what I know about squalls. But a squall is basically a drastic increase in wind or wind speed that lasts for at least a minute. So I guess it's just like a big ass gust.
Guess so. But typically very, very powerful.
Yes. Typically, to be considered a squall, the wind speed must increase at least 8 meters per second with a top speed of at least 11 meters per second. That means nothing to me, but if you know meters or per second, then that tells you something.
Yeah. If you're going to use terms like meters or even, I know in sailing, it's like knots. I'm like, I do not know what a knot is.
I know miles per hour.
Well, and even that's a little dicey to me.
It's dicey. Yeah. Yeah. Harvey said that the sudden wind caused the boat to rock from side to side, and then it eventually caused the main mast to snap. And when it snapped, Harvey said that it slightly injured his wife and some members of the Dubrow family before it pierced the hull of the boat. So he then went on to say that when the mast fell, it cut him off from the rest of the people on board because all of the rigging and ropes made it impossible for him to pass. How fortuitous that yeah. It would make everybody else impossible to survive and only he was able to get away.
And right next to a dinghy.
A fully stocked dinghy, but we'll right there. He went into the cabin to retrieve something to cut them with, but then a fire broke out. He's like, look, I would have helped them. Okay. Sure. Except then I turned around and there was a fire. And then I tried to put the fire out, but
then a dragon came out of nowhere.
I mean, who was expecting that, right? Like, I can't help that. Yeah. So it's just kind of like, interesting that no matter how hard he tried, it was like the universe was out to get his efforts. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And Mark wrote in here just a little note of his own, but he said it kind of reminds him of like when a little kid is telling a story and you can clearly tell that they're lying, but they just keep going, you know, and like, and then this, and then, oh, and whoa, and then that happened. Like, you know, it's just...
Right.
The crew was immediately like, I don't know about that. But he kept going and he said that due to the fire, he was unable to rescue his wife or any of the other passengers. And he reluctantly, Lord knows he didn't want to. He had to. He reluctantly.
Bless that little heart.
I know. Abandoned ship and climbed into the dinghy that they ended up finding him in. And not long after he got in the dinghy, he saw the body of Renee floating nearby and he pulled her in to try to resuscitate her.
Well, and he cared so much and he really, really wanted to make sure that everybody got in safely. But he was like, oh, hey, look, there's that kid. Hey, you.
Yeah, that's
one
of those
kids. Even though I don't even know who the hell you are. Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of them there. And I mean, honestly, what he said was, and I believe him, that he ultimately wanted to rescue her, right? Like he wanted to resuscitate her. He was unfortunately unsuccessful, but he wanted to keep her body with him out of respect so that she could be laid to rest.
Well, what a stand-up guy. Yeah.
I know it.
Yeah. It's like on Three Men and a Baby where Tom Selleck, I know you didn't watch any parts that didn't have Steve Guttenberg in it, and that's fine. But Tom Selleck, he goes to get the baby formula because when they first get her, you know, Mary. And he's like, I need whatever. I need baby food. And they're like, well, the woman that's helping him is like, well, do they need formula or that's for older babies? And she's like, how old is your baby? And he's like, I don't, this old. Yeah. And holds up his hands like, I don't know. I feel like that is Harvey in this where he's like, I don't know, the one that's yay that one. That's the child I'm talking
there
about.
There is one that's like a little, this one's a little newer. This one's a little, I don't know. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So people initially, like authorities, that crew that found him, like everybody was a little like, but Eve, but is that what happened? Because now, and we say this all the time, you cannot use somebody's demeanor as evidence. It's not evidence, but he was like real fucking calm for somebody who had basically watched his wife. Like he knew that she drowned and suffered a horrible death unexpectedly.
It didn't, but he was carrying the body of a dead child with him. That seemed to affect him not at all. He was just like, here is a dead body of a child. Out of respect, I want to be sure that she's buried. And more like he's not like, oh my gosh, I've been on a boat with a dead, like a baby. Like, to me, that's a baby, you know? Like, I don't know.
I have a reaction when I have found a spider in my car. You know what I mean? Like, now call me dramatic, but like, I've had stronger reactions to way less harrowing and tragic things than he.
Well, also to be like out to sea, like you don't know if you're going to come across somebody. That's got to be terrifying. And he wasn't like, no, he was waving frantically, but he wasn't like, I don't know what you might expect, like shaking and being like, oh my gosh, I didn't know if anybody, I thought I was going to just die out there. Like, I just didn't know, you know, he just kind of seemed like, oh, okay, that's done. Like, you know, and again, demeanor is one thing. Additionally, though, it wasn't just the demeanor. I mean, one thing was the story kind of sounded like bullshit, but remember he said he didn't know that any of this was going to happen, right? All of a sudden, this squall came up out of nowhere. Nobody was expecting that. They weren't prepared for it. The mast snaps. Everybody else goes this way. He's trying to cut the ropes to get across to them. And then bingo bongo, the fire breaks out. The dragon flies in. The sea kraken comes up.
Exactly. And he narrowly escapes it. What is that? The video. Oh, Lord Jesus, there's a fire. Like, remember?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, and he says all of these things happen out of nowhere. You have no idea that they're coming. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yet, the dinghy that he found on was fully stocked with survival supplies. Now.
Well, that is incredibly lucky for him. And in no way suspicious. Lucky.
Now, I am not a maritime professional by any means.
Maritime aficionado.
Right. I don't know. Somebody could come in the comments and say, well, you always stock your dinghy on a ship like that because you never know. But the officials, the other maritime aficionados, I mean, these are crews on ships out to sea. They found that to be odd, that it feels like that's not something that would normally happen. And again, if you have no idea it's coming, how'd you get all that stuff out there? It's like if somebody were to say a fire broke out at their house that they weren't expecting, but somehow they had all of their expensive jewelry and all of their family photo albums, you know, but nobody else made it out. It was so quick that nobody else could make it out of the house or, you know, I don't know, like.
Yeah, no way. Yeah, for sure. For something to happen, to just come right up on you without any warning, but you seem to be especially prepared for it, is mm-hmm. very confusing.
Right. Now, they couldn't disprove his story necessarily. They didn't have, at that time, anything to say otherwise. So they let him go back to Miami on November the 15th, but they knew that he was going to go through further questioning with the Coast Guard. On November 16th, this is 3 days after he was rescued, a Greek firefighter, nope, that's not that word.
It's got a lot of the same letters in it, though.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It really does, though. Yeah. You would just need like 8 more letters, but not really, but still.
Right.
It's a Greek freighter. That's not firefighter. I just saw like enough F's, R's.
G-H-T's.
Yeah, and I was like, firefighter, got it. A Greek freighter named Captain Theo was traveling through the Northwest Providence Channel, and this is the sea that separates the main island of the Bahamas from some of the smaller islands. The second officer of the ship, Nikolaos
Spatchidakis.
Okay, thank you.
I don't know how to say it.
Spotted something floating in the distance, and it was about a mile or so away from the firefighter. And so he radioed for the captain to come take a look as well. And initially, they thought it was like a small fishing vessel. However, when they see it, they're like, even if this is a fishing vessel, they've got to be in distress if they're at way the fuck out here, basically. So, you know, this is a very teeny little thing in a big, 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 big ocean. Like, you're in open water. This is not where you need to be. So they get closer. And as they get closer, they slowly realized it was not a small fishing vessel. It was, in fact, a small raft about 2 feet wide by 5 feet in length. Sitting on the small raft was a young blonde-haired girl in a white cotton blouse and pink corduroy slacks.
Angel.
Oh my gosh. Once they realized what they were actually looking at, the captain ordered the engines to be stopped and a rescue was set into action. The girl had been waving as frantically as she could. Here's a big difference between Julie and Harvey and anybody else that was involved in this shipwreck. Mm-hmm. She was waving as frantically as she could, but she was barely able to even move her arms. I mean, she was so weak and I mean, oh gosh. So the crew noted that there were sharks circling nearby. Hell no. Oh my gosh. So they shouted to her, like, stay on the raft. Don't jump in the water. Like, we will come to you. And I watched an interview with her and she said that the raft that she was on was one of, was like, it was really, really small. It was like basically a small float, but the outer edge of it, she would sit on that because the inside of it was not enclosed. It was like open rope. Like
it was like a net.
Yes, like a net. Yeah. So the fish were biting her when she had her feet, her whole body inside the water.
Well, yeah, she's, so it's like, gosh, I'm thinking of like, do you remember those old, what were those? Oh my gosh, what were they called? They were treats, like Little Debbie snacks, but they were like this and brown or black chocolate. And then they had the little swirly eyes.
Okay. Yes.
Remember that commercial where it's like a donut float and you're sitting with your booty in the hole and your legs out, but you've got your feet dangling.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly the way that she was sitting, but like trying to sit upright, but still.
Yeah. Yeah. She's trying to stay in there, but like all these fish were coming up and she said they were like, biting her
fish
feet
or something.
Like,
they were
like eating at her feet and they were like raw. So she was trying her best to sit herself up on the edge and keep all of her body on the float.
But there's only so much float.
There's so little room. Yeah. So she was brought on board and immediately placed in a spare cabin. The crew began to give her medical attention and just try to figure out how the hell she ended up out there. Unfortunately, they quickly realized that she was barely able to speak. And when she did talk, it was incoherent. Her body was covered in dried salt from the water, and the crew used wet towels to try to clean her skin. They put Vaseline on her lips because they were swollen and cracked from being in the sun for such an extended period. They gave her water and orange juice. And as they kept trying to help her, she slowly started to talk. And her voice was, as you can imagine, extremely hoarse. I mean, she's had no water. I used to think, of course, when I was a kid, I'm like, oh, if I got stranded out to sea, I'd just drink the water. Like, you can't drink salt water. Like,
no. And if you don't have anything to collect rainwater, or it doesn't rain.
It doesn't rain. Yeah, exactly. So they were able to make out that she was telling them that her name was Terry Jo Dupereau. She had told them that she'd been floating on the small raft for several days after their boat had sunk. And her ability to speak ended up rapidly declining, and she had to respond to simple questions just by using her hands or nodding. And her health ended up declining further, and she fell into what was described as a semi-comatose state.
Poor Angel. She just went through so, so much.
Oh my gosh.
Now,
imagine that though, 11 years old by yourself.
No.
At night. I mean, daytime too, but like,
mm-hmm.
Oh, breaks my heart.
Oh, I know. And the loneliness that you have to feel. And I can't. Okay, let's go ahead and get into learning mode, because we're going to learn about thalassophobia.
Mm-hmm.
This is described as an intense and persistent fear of deep or open bodies of water. Me. Don't confuse it, though, with aquaphobia, which is the fear of water itself, which, I mean, I think you can have both, I'm sure, but
yeah.
I am a thalassophobia person.
Yeah.
It can also include fear of being in deep bodies of water, fear of the vast emptiness of the sea, of sea waves, aquatic creatures, and being far away from land. And again, yes, yes, and a yes to all that. It is a common phobia that many people share. There are a few tales of being lost at sea that people may or may not be aware of. And one of those well-known ones, or one of the most well-known ones, is that of Louis Zamperini, which was made into a major motion picture called Unbroken, adapted from the book of the same name. Lewis competed in the 1936 Olympics in the 5,000-meter distance run. He finished eighth, but ran an extremely fast last lap, which caught the eye of the chancellor of the host country. Maybe another trigger warning. Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, that's the one you don't want to catch the attention of, unfortunately.
Hello. That guy is, I don't know. There's not even a word. Yeah. I could think of all of them, but they don't cover it, you know?
Yeah.
So reportedly Hitler shook his hand and said, quote, ah, you're the boy with the fast finish. When World War II broke out, Lewis enlisted in the Air Force and was a bombardier.
I thought it was bombardier, but I know that
you're
that's
so French.
Right.
A bombardier.
Yeah. A crew member on a bomber aircraft is what
let's
Mark
say that.
Tells us.
Yes.
He knows we're like the bombardier.
I know. All I can think of for whatever reason is Meet the Parents, like bomb, 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 bomb. Like, I don't, because you can't say bomb on an airplane. You just really can't.
You cannot.
No. Let's pretend like that moment in time did not happen.
Okay.
In April of 1943, Lewis and his crew were sent out on a search mission for a downed plane and the crew aboard. While searching about 850 miles south of Oahu, their plane malfunctioned and went down in the ocean.
No.
Yeah, that's terrifying. 8 of the 11 crew died during the crash, leaving just Lewis and 2 others. No, no. They had very little food and water and survived on rainwater, small fish they were able to catch and eat raw, and then birds that they trapped after they landed on the small raft they were on. The will to survive, man.
Hey, you guys. It's us again.
Yay, it's us.
We threw you for a loop on this one. So we know that a lot of you have been asking, like, WTF, where are episodes 1 through 44? And guess what? Now you can have them.
So let's just remember, though, we need you to take a little caution here. We didn't know exactly what we were doing back then. And we started this podcast as just a fun thing to do as sisters. We had no idea that it would grow into this super awesome club with you guys. So what we're saying is the audio wasn't super amazing, but the content is 100% us. Just being us and talking about some true crime with 90s flair.
Okay, so here are the details. You'll be able to access our what we're calling OG episodes in your favorite podcast app through a private and custom RSS feed link. So to grab that, head over to killerqueens.link/OG and snag episodes 1 through 44 today. That's killerqueens.link/OG.
Frances McNamara, one of the other survivors, used an oar to fend off an attacking shark at one point. Unsuccessfully attempted to get the attention of passing search planes. And at different points, Japanese planes flew over and strafed them. And if you don't know what strafe means, it's the military practice of attacking ground targets from low-flying aircraft using aircraft-mounted automatic weapons.
Oh my gosh, you're like, oh my gosh, a plane, and they're like shooting at you, and you're like, no, that's...
Two things that come to mind here, because my mind, of course, if you know me by now, it's going to go to songs, commercials, apparently, and then also movies, but I'm thinking of 6 Days, 7 Nights, mm-hmm. Great movie, when they're like, yes, a boat. And they're doing and they're like, oh my God, it's pirates. And then they have to turn their little asses back around.
Yeah. And also, the rafts out there, like you or I might think, or at least I would think, that'd be easy to spot, right?
100%.
Because it's like a white raft and the water is dark because vast and open. Mm-hmm. And if you're up high, you're gonna spot that raft immediately. However, the wave caps are white. So that, you know, when the waves come up and they have that foamy looking shit at the top of them, that's a wave cap. Well, that's white. So if you're way the fuck up here and you look down, you're like, nothing to see here. White, there's white, just white, wave white, caps. White, yeah. White.
Yeah. Which I guess is why, especially in that movie, I don't know how it goes for everybody now, but in that, I say now, that came out like 25 years ago, but
don't say me that.
I'm sorry, but it did. But that one was orange. Orange. So maybe that's why. Also, I'm thinking of the movie Gravity, where you get lost. Because I think of all the reasons why I would never want to be lost in space, right? Never occurred to me ever, ever, ever that if something is in orbit and it misses you, right? And you're like, oh, thank God it didn't hit me. Just give it time because it's going to come back around and get your ass.
Yep. Yeah. Now you're just now you're just in waiting mode.
Yes.
Like knowing it's coming.
Yes. Now it's like, I should have a list of like things to be afraid of today.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, so after 33 days at sea, McNamara passed away and Lewis and Russell Phillips, the other survivor, wrapped his body up in a tarp and laid him to rest at sea. After 46 days at sea, their raft washed up on the Marshall Islands in the Northwest Pacific Ocean, which was occupied by the Japanese. Like, worst place during that time to wash up.
Yeah.
They were immediately taken as prisoners of war, which they were severely beaten and tortured until the end of the war in August of 1945. Before his release, Lewis had been reported by the government as missing at sea and then declared dead. When the war ended, he was released and returned home to a hero's welcome. Later in life, he became a born-again Christian, working with Billy Graham. He talked a lot about redemption and forgiveness and even visited some of the guards who held him captive to tell them he forgave them. And he died in July of 2014 at the age of 97. Well, he's like the definition of anti-Final Destination. Like, death came for him so many times and he just,
I know, like, to go through all of that, being lost at sea, the plane going down, like, first of all, 8 out of the 11 people didn't even survive that part. Then he goes, you know,
sharks.
Keeps going. Yeah, sharks and all these things. One of their other survivors did not make it. They finally wash up somewhere and they're taken as prisoners of war and just tortured.
I know.
I mean, I don't know. I hope that I would have that much of a will to survive, but I don't know. After the first or second layer of hell that they went through, I don't know if I might just be like, you know what? I'm done. But he didn't.
No, he didn't.
It's incredible.
It is incredible. Another man, Jose Salvador Alvarenga, set out on a deep sea fishing trip from the coast of Chiapas, Mexico. Forgive me. Jose was an experienced sailor and fisherman, and this trip was going to be a 30-plus hour trip in which he was hoping to catch marlin and sharks. His usual crewmate was unable to join him, so he hired an inexperienced 23-year-old that he had never met. It's putting a lot of faith in a basic stranger, but...
Mm-hmm.
Shortly after they set out, a storm came upon them quickly and blew them off course. The storm lasted 5 days, and during it, their motor and most of their electronics were damaged, rendering them absolutely useless. They did have close to nearly 1,100 pounds of fresh fish, but they had to dump most of it overboard so they could control the boat's movements in bad weather. That's got to be heartbreaking. Like,
oh, yeah.
Jose managed to use a two-way radio to get a hold of his boss to tell him they needed help, but the battery died shortly after that. They had no sails, no anchors, oars, running lights, and no way to contact the shore. They had some basic supplies and little food. Jose's boss organized a search party, but they found no trace of them. Days turned into weeks, and the two men scavenged for food when they could. Jose caught fish, turtles, jellyfish, or birds with his bare hands. At almost 4 months into their voyage, Jose said that his crewmate refused to eat any more raw food and slowly died from starvation. For the next few days, Jose said that he contemplated suicide, but his faith kept him from going through with it. For 6 days, he kept the other man's corpse on the boat in hopes that he would be able to bury it. But then at some point, he started to talk to it, and he was scared that he was losing, like beginning to lose his mind. So he ended up throwing the body overboard. Jose said that he had spotted numerous large ships while at sea, but he was never able to get their attention. He tracked the lunar cycle to try to keep an idea of months and days. And then after he counted his 15th lunar cycle, he spotted land. This was a small island, part of the Marshall Islands, the same one that Lewis landed on. And once he was close enough, he jumped from his boat and swam to shore. He found a remote beach house, and it had been 438 days. This was supposed to be a little more than 30 hours.
Oh my gosh.
More than a year. And it was estimated that he had traveled 5,500 to 6,700 miles. He spent 11 days in the hospital before being released, and his tale was eventually published as a book, 348 Days, An Extraordinary True Story of Survival at Sea.
Yeah, and that's actually 438 if you're trying to do the numbers in the actual order.
What did I say?
348.
Mother! Damn it. In my mind was like, nailed it.
Nailed it.
Did so good. I struggle. Numbers are not my friend.
Yeah. I mean, I said firefighter and the word was freighter.
And it's freighter, yeah.
Just, you know, things happen.
Whoopsie.
All right. So back to Julian Harvey. As we mentioned, Terry had been rescued on November 16th. And that same day, Julian Harvey was talking with U.S. Coast Guard investigators and was telling them the same story that he'd been telling, right? The sudden weather destroyed the mast. There's a hole in the ship's hull, ruptured gas tank, started a fire. Couldn't save anyone, found Renee, out of respect, tried to bury her, whatever. He also had a scheduled interrogation on the 17th. And during that, he was told that Terry had been rescued the previous day and that her health was improving. So they said that, you know, the whoever was going to deliver the news, like to the, I don't think they were necessarily going to tell Julian Harvey, but just to get the word out there to, you know, who all is working this thing or whatever. And they bust in and they're like, oh my gosh, Terry has been saved. She's been found. And they said, Julian was like, oh my God. And then he was like, isn't that wonderful? like it kind of like the fear and like came out at first. And then he was
shock
like,
I mean, yeah.
I'm so happy to hear that. So they said, all right, we're launching an official investigation into this. Shortly after being told this, he was like, listen, I'm real tired, obviously, because I've been through a harrowing experience. And I need to talk to my wife's family. You know, like I've been trying to handle your business side of this, but I've really got to handle the life side of it. And I'm exhausted. And so please let me rest. And they were like, of course. So he goes to a nearby motel. He paid cash for a room and he gave them a fake name. Once inside, he wrote a 2-page suicide note to a close friend from his military days. He then used a razor blade to slash his thigh, ankles, and jugular vein. The letter didn't give any reason for his actions, but that, quote, I got too tired and nervous. I couldn't stand it any longer. The note requested that the friend take care of his 14-year-old son and that his body be laid to rest at sea. By November 20th, Terry Jo's health had improved greatly, and she was able to tell them what happened that night on the Bluebell. So Terry said that late on the 12th, she went to a lower cabin to lay down, and her parents, siblings, Julian Harvey and his wife were all up on deck. She was woken up from her sleep by the sound of her brother screaming for their father to help him. Then she heard some loud banging. She said not like gunshots, but like something hitting up above her. She heard someone running on deck too. And so she made her way up, which first of all is like super brave because she's like, what is going on up there? She goes up and she sees the bodies of her brother and mother in the main cabin. And they're like in pools of blood. She continued to the main deck and she saw Julian Harvey carrying a bucket. He hit her and told her to go back below deck. So she went back down until she saw oil and water gushing into the cabin about 15 minutes later. Harvey then comes into the cabin with a rifle in his right hand. He did not shoot her. They made eye contact and Harvey went back above deck. So Terry goes back up and she sees Harvey standing holding a rope that's connected to the ship's dinghy. And he asked her if the dinghy was loose and she told him she didn't know. So he gives her the rope and says, you hold on to this while I go to get something. But while he was gone, the rope had slipped from her hand. So when he comes back up and he sees that, he just dives overboard and he swam toward the dinghy. And then she just by herself. And she had asked him a couple times, like, is the boat sinking? Like, what do we do? And she said he just like didn't respond to her. He didn't look at her. He didn't talk to her. He just went on about his business. So now she's on this boat all alone and she knows it's sinking. And the presence of mind of an 11-year-old, I mean, I don't think that she had any like boat experience before this. I mean, I think this is like, you know, she's been on a boat for 4 days, but like, that's it as far as like her life experience on a boat. But she remembered that there was a little cork float that was tied to the side of the boat. So she ran over there. She gets it loose. She threw it over the side and jumped towards it as the boat sank. She climbed on and then drifted on it for 3.5 days with no food, no water, or cover from the sun. It was so small, like we said, that she couldn't even lay down. She had to sit up the entire time, not to mention that the bottom of it was like an open net. But she was adamant that the mast of the boat was intact and there was no weather or fire at all that night. There was no bad weather.
I'm guessing she's going to say there was no Kraken too.
Maybe she didn't see the Kraken. I don't know.
Okay. What about a Burt McCracken?
Some kind of Kraken. I don't know.
Yeah.
An investigation was launched into Julian Harvey, given Terry's account of what had happened and his suicide. They learned that after the war, he had a difficult time keeping a job for any length of time and had some serious financial problems. He had recently arranged a double indemnity insurance policy for his wife. And so this was one of those clauses that says if the death is an accident, it will pay double whatever, like the double indemnity, it will pay double the amount. So he needed, if he was going to commit insurance fraud or kill somebody for insurance, he needed his wife to die due to an accident.
An accident, yes.
Yeah. So he had also been hired by the owner of the boat a month before Arthur had chartered it. And the owner paid him $300 a month to take people out and gave him and his wife accommodation on the boat as well. And investigators suspected that this might have sparked the idea of killing his wife at sea. So they thought, I mean, this is, and they had only recently gotten married. I mean, like, it's just terrible. So they thought that his plan was to kill her and dispose of her body with no one noticing, saying, oh my gosh, she must have fallen overboard. Like she must have drowned. I don't know. And then because he was chartering, like captaining this, you know, ship for a whole family, everybody was on board. Nobody heard anything. Like,
or saw anything, right?
So it's nobody saw anything. Like she was there and then she wasn't there. Definitely wasn't me. Like just a tragic accident. I've got all these witnesses essentially to back me up. So what they think happened is that when he went to do whatever it is that he was going to do, somebody saw it. And then he decided they've all got to go too. Because now it's going to look real suspicious if two people fall overboard.
Right.
Or three people or whatever.
So now we got to sink the whole boat and do the whole thing.
Exactly. Mary was Harvey's sixth wife. His second wife had died in a car crash along with her mother in very suspicious circumstances. In 1949, Harvey was driving with them in the car when the car plunged off a bridge at high speed. Some sources say he was in the car when it did this, and then he got out and swam to shore, but others say that he jumped out right before the car plunged into the water.
He is a scammer, or was, excuse me, mm-hmm. a scammer, a murderer,
mm-hmm.
just a piece of trashes. This is so awful.
And when they investigated that and like looked at the state of the car and everything, I can't remember exactly what it was, but he said something like that he had opened the door to get out or whatever somehow and that nobody else was able to do that or something like that, or that he couldn't get anybody else out or something. But like, I think the window they found, the window was down on his side and like, and you know, you didn't have push buttons. Like that window was already rolled down when he went off, if that's how he jumped out. So it's like, it just, none of it added up.
Well, and like we've talked about before, in these kinds of situations, to have this many coincidences, that's outrageous. Like for him to be in two near-death experiences, at least, we're going to talk about more, but at least, and for him to narrowly escape, but not be able to save not one other person, that's just outrageous. And also it's like, if it was true, which it's not, but if it was, you would not have wanted Julian Harvey around in an emergency.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Especially, and he's like got all this training in the military and like,
yeah.
Yeah.
But he's like a damn kiss of death.
For real.
Because he is.
He really is. Yeah. So another incident occurred when he was captaining a boat that ran into the wreckage of the warship San Marcos, which had sunk in 1911 in shallow water.
Who is this unlucky? My God.
I know. And you could see it coming. Like, and the crew was like, hey, don't run into that. Hey, that wreckage is there. Hey, why are we getting this close? Like, there's no reason we're getting this close. Hey, let's don't get this close. And then he got that close anyway, because he said he was trying to read an inscription on a buoy that marked the site. And he was like, well, I can't. If I could get a little closer. And then he's like, oh God, ran into it. I had no idea that was coming. In 1958, a powerboat that he owned also sank under suspicious circumstances off the coast of Cuba.
Again, it's 6 days, 7 nights. I don't know why it's so stuck in my head. I'm going to have to watch it. But it's like, I float with you twice, you crash half the time. Like, this guy, you can't, how? Well, obviously he didn't tell anybody, but like, yes.
Right.
You have captained 9 boats and 10 have crashed.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, exactly. Like, and it's kind of one of those things where like, you know, there will be people, I know we've covered cases where they're like, I mean, but that just happened to happen. But that just happened to happen. And it's like, okay, but the fact is you'd have to be the unluckiest person in the world for all of these things to line up this way and you had nothing to do with them. Like,
absolutely.
Not to mention that each of these accidents and tragedies resulted in large sums of money being paid out to him by insurance companies.
He's unlucky, but he apparently is very lucky too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It just so happened that all of those policies, it's like, what was that documentary series called? Murder Among the Mormons or Murder?
Murder Among Mormons.
Murder
Among Mormons. Yeah.
So it's like kind of that situation where like all of these people, like once the guy, and I forget his name now, the bad guy. Well, he is bad. The bad guy. Once he learned
the document that, traitor.
Yeah. Once he learned that like these organizations were looking for these very specific long lost documents that people didn't even know if they existed and blah, blah, blah. He's like, you tell me what document you want and then I will somehow find it. And, you know, it's just like, so you tell me how much money I can make in this and what the very specific clauses that will pay out the most. And I don't know how it happened. I'm just this lucky, but somehow those things ended up happening. And so now I get to maximize my insurance payout. Sure, some people died along the way.
Well,
can't help that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like it just, ugh. So Terry Joe ended up returning to Green Bay and lived with family. And given the time that this took place, it's probably not a shock. She did not receive any type of trauma counseling or anything. In fact, many authority figures rarely, if ever, spoke about the tragedy with her. And she didn't speak publicly about it for over 20 years. She married and had 3 children and is now retired in Wisconsin. In 2010, she released a memoir called Alone, Orphaned on the Ocean, co-written by psychologist and survival expert Richard Logan. Almost 50 years after everything happened, she granted her permission for a TV interview with Matt Lauer on the Today Show. During the interview, she encouraged people not to feel sorry for her, saying, quote, I always believed I was saved for a reason. If one person heals from a life tragedy after reading my story, my journey will have been worth it.
What a strong, strong, strong person. And I am so glad that I hope that this doesn't come across as selfish, but I'm so glad that she found it within her to share her story because it is so inspirational. Like there's no telling how many people that has affected in such a very positive way. But I just,
absolutely.
Everything she's overcome and all because of this shit bag. It's just so sad.
Yeah. And by the way, all of these like war hero stories and stuff that he was telling everybody. None of those were even true. He crashed his own plane. Like you said, you've flown or you've captained 9 boats and you crashed 10. Like literally, he would go out on these, I don't know what they're called, missions or something. I don't know. But like he'd have to fly the plane or whatever. And somehow the plane would malfunction 99% of the time. He wouldn't make it to where he was supposed to go, or the plane would go down and like all this stuff. And he wouldn't make it to where he was supposed to go. So he never really made it to any combat or anything. He just, like, it was very obvious that he was just trying to not go.
Right. Like,
and that's what, like, he did all the time.
Come back as a war hero, but not actually be involved in any war efforts at all.
No.
In fact, like, just wasting money, government money. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's so Julian Harvey.
Yeah. So he's the worst.
Obviously. How? Well, con men, scammers, 6 wives. And he wasn't, he was 44?
And also, what really burns my bucket about this, is he was being paid $100 a day by the Dupereau family in 1961.
That's like $1 billion.
Damn money. Yeah. So if he had just done that maybe a few more times, he probably would have gotten himself out of his financial, you know, like if he had just put that time and effort into, hey, I've found something that can be lucrative for me that I also really enjoy. My wife can come along with me. We can do this together and we can make money. But instead, he was like, well, I can get a one-time payment and then I can be, you know, go do whatever I want to do or whatever. It's just like he could have had a fulfilling life if he had just literally done one other thing. I don't know.
But you got to think, because, and I don't know how, there have to be studies about this, but because this is not, he's not the first person to do this, obviously, right? I mean, I have to say the majority of what I have seen, maybe about like insurance or like life insurance, well, that's not true, but I've watched a lot recently, I guess, where it's like black widows. So it's like women who have done this to their husbands, right? Or even children in some cases, which is just awful. But I wonder how much of it is obviously financially driven, but maybe like, that, I don't know what they call it now. There's a different term for Munchausen, but like the sympathy, like, oh my gosh, you survived this terrible tragedy.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. That like heroic aspect, or the, I can't believe you've been through that. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause you can't, that's true. You can't live I mean, you could, and God forbid you went through something like that and hopefully you survived it, but that, you know, it takes a toll. I understand. But a normal person is not going to live through 95 tragedies.
Right. And obviously, that's a big motivator for him. You make a very good point, because he lied about all of his accomplishments up until that point, too. He talked about all of these combat situations he was in and like all of this stuff. And, you know, once you actually like go back and look at his records, he called out that day, like literally every single time. So like he obviously was looking for recognition, you know, it was like kind of puffing up his ego too.
Yeah. So you can't be on the straight and narrow and get all that too. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Or you can't be a Julian Harvey and get all that too. So
yeah. Yeah. But that's it, you guys. Let us know what you think. And you know, we'll catch you on the next one.
Bye. Love you.
Bye. Love you. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. Connect with us on Instagram or Facebook to continue the conversation.
Thanks for listening, and we will meet you back here next week.
Bye!
The theme song for the show is created and composed by Stephen Toby. You can find more of Stephen's work on SoundCloud.
Our logo was created by Sloan Williams of Sophisticated Crayon. You can find more of her work on Etsy. Visit us at killerqueenspodcast.com for merch and other info about the show.